Argument from the relators.
Okay, please record Mr. Matthews will present argument for relators.
May I please record?
Counsel.
My name is Doug Matthews and I represent the relators, Stanley Jampole and his family, the plaintiffs below in this original mandamus action against Honorable Thomas Stovall as respondent. As the court may know, this case arises out of a lawsuit brought on behalf of Mr. Jampole and his children as a result of the death of Mrs. Jampole in a so-called post-crash fuel-fed fire type of incident or case involving a 1976 Vega automobile. The incident occurred down near Wharton, Texas. Arising out of that incident was this lawsuit brought on products liability, negligence, and gross negligence theories against General Motors and the driver of the vehicle which rear-ended the 1976 Vega in which Mrs. Jampole was an occupant. This particular action arises out of a series of discovery matters where plaintiffs, relators, were seeking discovery from General Motors by interrogatories and requests for production filed, several different ones filed last fall, and heard by Judge Stovall in a couple of hearings this spring. The discovery was in part granted and in part denied, and it is the scope of that order which is presented by this mandamus action before this court. The plaintiffs contend, relators contend, that Judge Stovall clearly abused his discretion in denying the discovery sought by relators for a number of reasons. I'd like to first, before getting into the specifics of the discovery and the specifics of the order, I'd like perhaps to give the court a little further background on the facts of this case and the theory of the case so that the court will understand the framework in which we're dealing. This case is like other cases which have been in the news, like the so-called Pinto type of cases where plaintiffs contend that the fuel system on the 1976 Vega was defectively designed and manufactured. Plaintiffs contend that there were a number of alternative designs which could have solved that problem and which would have prevented a rupture of the fuel system in such a manner as to allow fuel to enter the passenger compartment and with an ignition source cause a fire and burn Mrs. Jampole to death while she was seated in the front seat of the automobile. Specifically, she was seated there as a passenger, simply waiting on her husband while he had gone across the road to get some help for some automobile trouble they were having of some sort. They were parked on the shoulder, and the other vehicle came along and rear-ended them on the shoulder. There is a contention by that defendant that he was having some sort of health trouble and had a blackout and went off the road and rear-ended the Vega automobile. The kinds of discovery being sought have to do with the testing and also with the consideration of alternative types of designs of this fuel system by General Motors Corporation, as well as the policies and mental processes of General Motors with respect to find ways to avoid this type of problem in connection with a proposed tough federal fuel system standard that was being proposed at the time but was never enacted. Additionally, there are certain additional matters, including a so-called master crash test index, which we contend General Motors has, which would show what tests are available and what are not. The interrogatories, sets of interrogatories, requests for productions, were almost entirely objected to by General Motors. That is, almost each and every one on a wide variety of reasons: harassment, cost, burdensomeness, attorney-client privilege, virtually every conceivable objection that one could make. When we finally got to the hearings, the basic position by General Motors, at least according to testimony, and the affidavit was one of relevancy, and primarily relevancy directed to the model cycle of the Vega. The Vega, for the court's benefit, is a small car, as the court may know, a so-called H-body car. It had a twin sister called the Pontiac Astra, which was simply put out under a different name, but was basically the same car. And the model cycle for the Vega was from 1971 to 77. This accident occurred on April 14, 1979, and involved a 76 Vega. The production of the Vega was discontinued after 1977, and it hasn't been manufactured since 1977. After objections of all conceivable kinds were made by General Motors, when we got to the hearings, their position by General Motors, as far as evidence was concerned, by way of affidavit and live testimony from their consulting expert, Mr. Chakowsky, was simply that only certain portions of the model cycle, if you will, that is, only some cars of the Vega series from 1971 to 1977 should be discoverable. In other words, the focus of the hearing primarily had to do then with whether there were differences between the Vega from 1971 through 77, with General Motors contending that there were about three different types of cars, slightly different during that time. The court granted us discovery from 71 to 77. As I read the record, I see no evidence put forward by General Motors, by affidavit, or by live testimony, disputing the relevancy or what we call secondary relevancy, that is the kind under the rules as enunciated in the Allen versus Humphrey case, may lead to relevant evidence. We see no dispute of that relevancy as to the other matters sought but denied by the court's order of March 25, 1983. That is to say, we suggest for this court's benefit that on the matters, the principal chunks of discovery denied by this court's order, there was evidence of relevancy and secondary relevancy put forth by relators and no evidence put forth disputing that on most of those substantial chunks of denied discovery by General Motors. There was some contest by General Motors of some portions of the relevancy of some of the alternative design materials that we saw. But there was no dispute from a relevancy standpoint of the Master Crash Test Index. There was some question raised about the plans and specifications sought by our discovery, but that had to do with the alleged sensitivity of that data, which we suggested is more properly a matter for protective order and had nothing to do with whether or not the matters were discoverable. That is to say, there was no contention that those plans and specifications weren't relevant or didn't have secondary relevance. Rather, they were saying they might be sensitive in some fashion, and we suggested that the proper approach would have been a protective order as to particular plans or specifications. Instead, we were denied those carte blanche. Now, we suggest by way of background that the pattern of General Motors in this case is not a new one. This pattern has been pursued where discovery of this type of sought in this type of case in many, many other cases around this country. That is to say, plaintiffs seek this kind of discovery. General Motors objects to each and every item. And then finally, if some discovery is granted, in many instances, in fact in most that we know anything about, protective orders have been obtained by General Motors from the particular trial judge so that the discovery obtained by the plaintiff cannot be shown to any other plaintiff or any other party in any other part of the country. There is no way to, therefore, check to see whether or not the discovery is complete. And there is no way to check as to whether or not it is thorough and whether or not it is everything that should be produced. This presents a particularly difficult problem for plaintiffs' relators in this case because there are relatively few experts who have any knowledge of this type of a problem. Our expert in this case is a man by the name of Mr. Robert Pouch, and he has been involved as an expert in some 400 of these post-crash fuel-fed fire cases. He is a former design engineer for the Ford Motor Corporation. We also have employed as consulting expert in this case, Mr. Gil Kurup, who filed an affidavit for Mr. Kurup. He's a former engineer for General Motors Corporation. The problem is, then, where these experts are involved in the other cases is their hands are tied by the protective orders, and they cannot disclose to you either the identity of the documents or their specific contents.
These experts have been allowed discovery in other cases, this information, and the expert knows about it.
Yes, sir.
He can't relate it to you.
That's correct, Your Honor. Specifically, in this case, almost the identical discovery we're after was produced in the Swanick case in Detroit only a few months ago with the same experts involved, Mr. Schakowsky for General Motors Corporation and Mr. Fouch for the plaintiff in that case. That order, incidentally, is attached in some of the papers that we filed among the papers of this cause.
Counsel, just as a matter of curiosity, obviously a lot of that testimony has come out in other cases scattered around the country. Are you saying that if you had access to that testimony of these experts in other cases in Detroit or wherever it might be, that that won't lead you or won't permit you to go into the same information in your case?
Well, Your Honor, pretty close, but the problem is that the documents we seek, the specific documents, are protected by these protective orders so that your expert can't tell you exactly what this document's number is, what its date is, what its title is, or specifically what its contents are.
Even though it's been revealed in another case,
he's read it. He's using it. He knows all about it.
Counsel, is this information available from any other source?
No, sir. We're talking about internal General Motors Corporation documents, Your Honor. They're not available from any other source. So that the problem then presents itself that the plaintiff in this kind of a case with these protective orders must from the beginning, so to speak, ab initio, start discovery and try to find out all of these kinds of things, both by way of interrogatories and by the seeking of the documents that are important. Because the expert can't give you specificity, you must use some broadness in the description of documents in terms of categories and types of documents. It is interesting, and I don't want to get too far off on the protective order, because so far Judge Stovall has not entered a protective order in this case. He has indicated he might do that. And we mentioned that in our briefs.
Incidentally, on that point, is Judge Stovall, in your opinion, still a proper respondent in this case?
Your Honor, that probably ought to have been changed since the court has been changed. Judge Stovall is no longer the 129th. Judge Touche has just only a few days ago replaced him.
Counsel, did Judge Stovall make a final order? Has he made a ruling from which he's not going to depart, or did he tell you, you go get this and then come back and I will reconsider it?
Your Honor, he used, as Judge Stovall can use, some words, and I noticed that the counsel is going to have him pour you up here on a placard where he said we can come back to the well.
My point is, do you still have a remedy down in the trial court?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I'd like to explain that. It'll take a little bit to explain it, but I...
Well, it would be important because our court's got a lot of things to do besides anticipate a judge's ruling.
Yes, sir. The point of the matter is, Your Honor, he has ruled with respect to specific large areas of discovery, critical areas as far as the plaintiff is concerned. And what he said, in effect, was if you discover some later relevance on these matters, though we think the evidence is all one way in the trial as far as we're concerned in the hearings, He said, you can come back to the well and re-urge these matters. That right is not any different, Your Honor, than we would have in any other situation. That is, if we later discover something that makes the matter that we think can now convince the judge that the matter should be discoverable, we can go and offer it to him and see if he'll change his mind. The point is, we're not likely to be able to do that. We have described these matters as best we can. He has cut us off both by interrogatories and by request for production. Our expert can't tell us about them. We can't depose their experts about them. There is no further way for us to obtain any more information than we now have, Your Honor. So that's an illusory kind of a thing, that we might later come back to the well, so to speak.
What you're saying is you can't find out any other information that might lead you back to the well.
We don't think we need to, Your Honor. We think we've already offered strong, relevant evidence of relevance with no counter by the other side. But moreover, we don't see any way that we can obtain any more information than we now have with respect to these kinds of documents. I might at this point mention the kinds of documents that we're talking about, the substantial groups that were denied. There are about five areas. There may be some little things here, and there are about five major areas. One is the so-called FMVSS 301 standard documents, or the other one is a different standard called, I believe it's 505, VSA 505. They're related fuel system integrity standards. They are going to impose on the car manufacturers a tough requirement of having to meet certain kinds of impacts without rupturing and without causing these kinds of terrible fires and explosions. Those were proposed in about the year 1967, and they were under consideration, as our evidence shows, by Mr. Pouch and Mr. Cura during the time from 1967 to about 1972-73, somewhere in that area. During those years, all manufacturers were engaged in heavy work in trying to meet those standards, and they had specific committees trying to meet those standards. And those committees, we believe, were having meetings, writing minutes, making policy considerations as to whether or not they're going to change the design of their fuel system, and in what cars, and how. It is those kinds of documents that we suggest are going to bear upon the intent of General Motors with respect to our gross negligence claims under Burke-Rawley. That is, did they manifest the necessary mental state of mind? The only way we're going to know that is to be able to find the documents where they're considering the very matters that are in question here. Those documents were denied by this order. Now, there's some dispute by the other side about that. They say, well, and the order is really peculiar. The order says that we're entitled to get so much as General Motors has voluntarily offered to give in so many words. And then we have to look back at another document, and what they offered to give essentially were documents that were so-called public comments and those which related to the 1976 Chevrolet Vega. Well, the period of time is 1967 to 1972 or 3. At that time, we don't have a 76 Vega. So that, by definition, knocks out those documents. Additionally, the public comments are those things which General Motors was furnishing to the federal government. And that's not what we're after. We can get those from the federal government. We're after the internal documents that were not furnished to the federal government. And that's explained in great detail by the experts in their testimony and affidavits. But those bear on the mental state of mind of General Motors and bear, and are relevant, we believe, strongly relevant to our gross negligence position. Additionally, we seek the testing done on just 4 years prior to the beginning of production of this car, the so-called pre-production phase. For some reason, Judge Stovall gave us from 1971 to 1977, the actual production years, when there's strong evidence that the real time when testing on a car goes on is during the years when you go through prototypes and experimental vehicles, which is about 4 years before. And we've been denied that entire period of time, which is critical to find out if they were trying to see if a fuel system different than the one that ended up on the Vega could be used on the Vega before they ever put a Vega into production in 1971. We have none of that information. That's been totally denied. We have offered the evidence of relevance, And secondary relevance on that, there is no evidence contrary by General Motors. That is, they did not contest its relevance or secondary relevance. Third area would be, I believe, the plans and specifications. I've already mentioned they do question that some of those may be competitively sensitive, and if that is true, I think protection for that might be particular or special protective orders, but it has nothing to do with the discoverability of those matters under the case law, and we've shown their relevance. Fourthly, the Master Crash Test Index. We believe that that crash test index will then tell us exactly whether, well, first of all, it's going to tell us whether or not we're getting all the tests that we should be getting. Secondly, it will tell us if there are other tests that we ought to be asking for that we haven't asked for, because it will show what tests have been performed. and so we believe that is both relevant and secondarily relevant. Lastly is the so-called alternative design documents, that is, where General Motors has used specific designs that we contend are ways to attempt to avoid this problem, such as putting the fuel tank over the axle rather than right behind the rear bumper, as it was in this case, such as having a so-called breakaway filler neck so as to avoid the problem that the filler neck breaks and just simply pours the gasoline like a spout down for a spark, as happened in this case, such as bladders, which are a different way to try to avoid the problem, such as a different construction of the fuel tank made of different materials other than so-called turn-plated steel. We specified these alternative designs and asked where they had tested those designs. Now, I've got to be completely candid with the court. I think that they have contested in some instances the relevance, the direct relevance of some of those alternative designs, and so there is some dispute on some of the alternative designs. We think that all those alternative designs are secondarily relevant, that is, they may lead to the discovery of relevant evidence under Allen versus Humphreys, but I cannot take a position with this court that the record is as clear on those from the standpoint of evidence showing the relevance and secondary relevance on one side by the plaintiffs and nothing on the other side by General Motors with respect to that particular category. Now, plaintiffs' relators here submit that there has been a clear abuse of discretion by Judge Stovall with respect to these matters. And perhaps one way to look at it is in the context of the case decided by this court and an opinion written by Justice Walker in Womack versus Berry. Womack versus Berry was a case where the relator was seeking a separate trial of a portion of a lawsuit, and I don't recall exactly, but I think one of the parties was one of the military service, and the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act was asserted, and in effect the other side was trying to put the whole matter off, and the party trying to get this one piece tried and seeking a separate trial brought forth evidence that a separate trial ought to be granted. And Judge Walker holds that that is a clear abuse of discretion to deny that separate trial when, as we have here in this case, all the evidence on the one hand supports a separate trial, there's no evidence the other way, but the trial judge goes the other way. And we suggest to this court that that is true on the issue of, really the only issues that might be before this court, that is relevance and secondary relevance, with respect to at least four of the five areas that we've talked about entirely. That is, the government standard materials, the committee minutes and so forth of General Motors and attempts to meet those standards, the pre-production phase testing, prototypes and experimental vehicles, the Master Crash Test Index, and the plans and specifications. With respect to those, it is just like Womack versus Berry. There was no contest of the relevance or secondary relevance by General Motors. and therefore we submit a clear abuse of discretion occurred by the trial court in denying that important discovery to us. We have suggested that these matters are discoverable from the standpoint of the of this court's decisions in Allen v. Humphreys and Barker v. Dunham. Allen v. Humphreys, as the court knows, is a case where this court held that even in a situation where the evidence could not have been directly relevant because it was a workman's comp case and the matters being discovered were basically fault kinds of matters and fault was not an issue in that comp case, nonetheless, this court held that they may lead to discoverable evidence. And we think we have a situation like that here, particularly where General Motors very effectively has our hands tied in terms of trying to get these documents anyplace else except from General Motors by as specific interrogatories and requests for production as we can draw, but without being able to know the precise number of the document, the precise title of the document, or anything about its contents precisely in advance. The other side makes, perhaps I'll save some of this for rebuttal, but the other side makes a comment about not only Judge Stovall saying we can come back to the well, but with respect to the manner in which he conducted himself. And I have no quarrel with the manner that Judge Stovall conducted himself. He normally conducts himself in a very fine manner. But the manner is not the issue before this court. It's the substance of the rulings. And that's been true in these kinds of matters, so far as I can see the cases, in each and every instance. If we want to talk about thoroughness, I'd go to such cases as Hudaley Industries versus Cunningham, where, for example, Judge Warren Cunningham was very thorough. He took all the documents in camera, and he looked at them very carefully, and he granted some discovery, and he denied some discovery after a very thorough consideration. This court looked at the substance, not at the manner. I think that's what happened recently in the Lawrence case. It looked to me as if Judge Lawrence at least certainly had taken a good deal of time in considering the matter and held several hearings, and the matter appeared to be very thorough. But the court, this court said the substance was not there. That is, there was a clear abuse of discretion in the scope of the order and what the order did, not in the manner by which the court went about it. So in summary, we submit we have a situation where we can't get this anywhere else, where this information and these documents are critical to important theories in our case, where we've been totally denied these matters, where we've proven and offered the evidence of direct and indirect or secondary relevance, where that's not really been contested, and where we've nonetheless been denied it, and we have no other way to go, no place else to go. And we suggest that a clear abuse of discretion has therefore occurred, and this and that mandamus should issue in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will hear argument from the respondent.
Mr. Jones and Mr. Sales will represent the respondent. Mr. Jones will open.
May it please the court. Jim Sales and I represent General Motors as lead trial counsel in this case, which is pending in Harris County. Dick Davis and Royal Brand are with the firm of Strasburger and Price. They are regional counsel for General Motors in what are called post-collision fuel-fed fire cases. We are all here today before the court, as we were in the Lawrence case several months ago. I'd like to start out by reminding the court that the judge whose conduct is at issue in this case was, at the time this matter was considered, the senior trial judge in Harris County. He was recently appointed the presiding judge of the 2nd Administrative Judicial District.
Do you think he's still a proper respondent here?
No, sir, I do not. Prior to the hearing, Mr. Matthews and I met with Judge Stovall to discuss the fact that Mr. Matthews had filed a motion to compel further answers to interrogatories and further requests for production from General Motors, and also to discuss the procedures that needed to be taken before the judge could issue a ruling. Judge Stovall mentioned that this was a new procedure to him. He was willing to hear whatever was relevant, and we set up a procedure whereby there would be a hearing with testimony taken. And Judge Stovall commented that this was In all of his years of having been on the bench, this was somewhat unique, and it was a new experience for him, and he was willing to go through the procedure of having a hearing and considering all the matters that were issued. When we went down to the courthouse for the hearing, Judge Stovall announced at the outset, "I am placing the burden on General Motors to go forward with the hearing. I feel that the plaintiffs have made a prima facie case with the affidavits that they have filed in support of their request for discovery." Those were the affidavits of Mr. Krupp and of Mr. Pouch that were previously mentioned by Mr. Matthews. We then had a hearing that took one full day with testimony from two witnesses. We came back at a later date for about a half a day of argument, and then we had a 2 or 3 hours discussion on the form of the order to be entered. At the conclusion of the day on which we heard testimony, after Judge Stovall had heard extensive testimony about the matters at issue, we went to a garage where two vehicles were stored, and Judge Stovall actually looked at two vehicles himself. This was not on the record, but was a discussion that, or was an observation of vehicles that had been agreed upon before the trip to the garage was made. The two witnesses who testified live at the hearing were Robert Pouch, who has been identified by Mr. Matthews as a so-called consulting expert for discovery purposes only. It is my understanding he will not testify at the time of trial. And Bill Chukowski, who is an in-house expert at General Motors who has extensive experience in fire investigation and who has testified as an expert witness on behalf of General Motors in these types of cases before. I would like to point out at the outset that the protective order issue is not before this court. Judge Stovall specifically reserved the question of a protective order until after he had had an opportunity to see what documents Mr. Matthews actually wanted us to reproduce and furnish to him and to hear further argument on it. So at this time, no protective order has been entered, and there is no protective order before this court. Now then, just to let the court know what we're talking about, and I realize our time is brief, but I want to give the court some ideas of what Judge Stovall had before him when he made his decision. This first photograph is a side view of a 1976 Sega hatchback. It's called a hatchback because the rear door opens up to an area behind the back seat, behind the front seat, which is flat. It is essentially the same as a small station wagon in that you've got a flat area from the back seat to the rear door. The photograph shows an interior view of the Vega hatchback, looking in the hatchback door, and you can see this flat space here with the two front passenger seats up here at the front of the vehicle. The next photograph shows a photograph of the actual jam pole vehicle that was involved in the accident. Superimposed on that is an outline of the side view of the Vega. This was before Judge Stovall so that he could get an idea as to the magnitude of the impact that the jam pole vehicle went through at the time of this collision. The next exhibit is one that we prepared in order to give Judge Stovall a breakdown as to the items that were at issue in the discovery hearing. There were some 40 or more interrogatories and some 30 or more requests for production, and we felt like it was the easiest way to deal with them was to give the court some sort of breakdown as to what was being sought. The first item here relates to the different types of Vega vehicles. The second one, the alternative fuel system designs, which includes the over-the-axle tanks and the bladders that Mr. Matthews mentioned, and claims and lawsuits, and then these FMVSS 301 documents that Mr. Matthews mentioned. Let me make it clear to the court at the outset that General Motors feels, as we indicated in Lawrence, that the test that should be applied in determining relevancy of documents is essential similarity. We prepared a chart and went through extensive testimony with the court to show the court why we felt that only certain information pertaining to the Vega, even though all these vehicles are called Vegas, would be information pertaining to an essentially similar vehicle and would be relevant. Judge Stovall rejected that testimony. He required us to produce what we didn't feel was relevant, what we still don't feel is relevant, and that is all item number one. Judge Stovall also required us to produce the information pertaining to the claims and lawsuits and the information pertaining to the federal documents. He did not require us to produce the information pertaining to the alternative fuel system design.
Judge Stovall had an...
Is there any pre-71 information on there that you were required to produce?
Yes, sir. We feel that there is, and in fact, such information has been produced. The information specifically is in the form of some test reports that these are items that Mr. Matthews has had an opportunity to review. These have been produced in our office, and he and his expert have looked through them. There is a test report dated May the 26th, 1970, pertains to a 1971 Chevrolet Vega. Its special features say new fuel tank installed for this test. That's prior to the time the vehicle ever went into on the market for production. Then a 1971 Vega prototype and production test results, or the test was dated October the 27th of 1970. The purpose of the test was to determine if the 1972 fuel tank meets the operational and durability standards of General Motors. Another one dated January the 15th of 1971. Special features, it says prototype 1972 fuel tank and evaporative emission control system. Our interpretation of the order was that all test results that pertain to Vegas for the model years 1971 to 1977, which are the years during which the Vega was manufactured, were required to be produced, whether they were actual model year tests or whether they were pre-production or prototype tests.
When we get to the alternative fuel system designs, the 1975 Corvette had a bladder tank in it. The bladder is located inside the fuel tank, and the fuel tank, as you can see, is just under the rear deck lid. You can contrast that with the inside of the 76 Vega hatchback. There are a number of differences, we say, between the fuel storage system on a Corvette and the fuel storage system on a Vega hatchback. In particular, we say that you cannot have a filler net and use a bladder. There was extensive testimony on the fact that if you're going to use a bladder, you've got to fill directly into the tank.
As relates to a gas tank, what do you mean by bladder?
Yes, please.
All right, a bladder is a rubber liner that is put inside the tank. The Corvette is the only commercially manufactured vehicle that uses a bladder. And our evidence to the court was to show why bladder documents were not relevant when you were talking about a Vega hatchback. Because a Vega hatchback it was not technologically feasible to use a bladder tank on a Vega hatchback, because you've got to fill directly into the tank as one of the considerations. And as you can see from looking into the rear of the Vega hatchback, you can't put your tank right there because you destroy the hatchback feature of the automobile. And Mr. Jakowski and Mr. Pouch both said that you can't have a hatchback with the technology available and have a bladder tank. In addition, there was evidence that bladders were not commercially available or available in commercial quantities such that they could be used on a mass-produced automobile such as the Vega if the technology was available. And Judge Stovall heard all of this evidence as well as other evidence as to why a bladder was not suitable for use in a 1976 Vega. Mr. Pouch's testimony was if you have either a bladder or you have your tank located over the axle, then even though there was a severe impact from the rear, the tank would not have ruptured and we wouldn't have had a fire. As you can see, there is no room in this vehicle for an over-the-axle tank. And that was another point that we went into at some length with Judge Stovall, and Mr. Pouch admitted you cannot have a station wagon or a hatchback and have an over-the-axle tank, because the over-the-axle tank goes in the area up behind the seat. You've got this flat area that won't take the over-the-axle tank. So that the tank on the Vega hatchback has to be as is shown in the next exhibit. This is the storage compartment or luggage compartment here, and this is the strap-mounted tank here, the top apparatus. So you can see that this is where the tank is located, and if you go back to the other photograph, that it could not have been located up behind the seat. The point of making all of this evidence available to Judge Stovall was to show to him that with regard to this particular automobile, documents pertaining to bladders and over-the-axle tanks would not be relevant and would not lead to the discovery of relevant evidence.
With regard to specific items that Mr. Matthews has mentioned that he says we have only partially produced.
This is an excerpt from the affidavit of David Martin, which was prepared in response to the court's discovery order with regard to these federal docket comments, the FMVSS 301.
And the court ordered that we produce this affidavit. Mr. Matthews says we're producing only the public comments.
As this affidavit says, it includes internal and public comments relating to federal dockets referenced in plaintiff's request for production number 42. He says the materials obtained by my staff at ASC, that's the Automotive Safety Engineering Committee of General Motors.
He cites to an affidavit of Mr. Pouch that he filed for the first time in connection with his petition for mandamus in this court, in which Mr. Pouch says, I have reviewed those materials produced in response to the court order pertaining to the federal docket, and it's not all there. This affidavit was never brought to the attention of Judge Stovall. We were never offered the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Pouch with regard to his contention that everything is not there. This is new evidence that is being offered in this court for the first time, asking this court to take the role of the trial court. We contend that we did produce what we were required to produce. It is documents that are internal and public comments, and it does relate to all of the comments from 1967 forward. It is not limited to the 1976 Vega. The other item that I mentioned just a few minutes ago has to do with the prototype and pre-production vehicles and the test results on those vehicles, and I have read excerpts from those reports to the court. Finally, the point that let me mention briefly the Master Crash Index. The Master Crash Index, I think, is some sort of red herring that has been dredged up for whatever reason. The testimony really was not before the trial court, so I don't think the trial court had an opportunity to consider that. But documents that have been filed with this court indicate that there has been testimony on prior occasions by General Motors witnesses in which they say that their crash test reports have been computerized, and if they need to do so, they can go to their computer index and make a search of their computer index and locate certain test results. There has been no testimony that there is a particular list of test results. And Mr. Pouch made an affidavit one way in this case, and then we filed a copy of some letters rogatory that were taken out of a court in California in which he said, well, he really didn't know about a Master Crash Index. I would also point out that in spite of these affidavits that Mr. Pouch has filed with regard to what we have produced and what we have not produced, Mr. Pouch has never been an employee of General Motors and has no personal knowledge of what goes on inside General Motors. I would also say to the court, and of course you can take it for what it's worth, that General Motors certainly, in light of what has been requested, tries to get its position across to the court as to what it feels is relevant and what it feels is discoverable. But when ordered to make discovery, General Motors makes the discovery. Mr. Matthews tries to leave the implication that we are intentionally hiding documents. I don't think there's anything to that. He makes the contention that we seek protective orders. Those protective orders are granted by trial judges all over the country. They are not something that General Motors manufactures or creates. They are granted by trial courts that have heard the evidence in the case. He mentions the Swanick case in Michigan and an order entered by the court in that case. In the Swanick case, the trial judge specifically refused to order the production of bladder documents after having a hearing such as the hearing that Judge Stovall conducted, because he felt they were not relevant to the particular facts of that case.
The thing that I want to finally bring to the court's attention is to show you the statement that was made by Judge Stovall at the conclusion of the hearing. And I don't intend, and have it by the language here, once you've done this activity, if you can then show relevance or need to what you have learned here, why you can come back again to the well.